We have with us live in the studios, once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. Good to have you back, Maria.
Thank you.
Yes, welcome back.
Let's start out. Got a lot to cover today. Start out with local and the Seattle City Council and paid sick leave.
Yeah, this week the Seattle City Council approved the paid sick leave ordinance, which would require businesses with 5 to 49 employees to provide five paid sick leaves, a minimum of five paid sick days to their employees. Businesses with 50 to 249 employees would have to provide a minimum of 7 days. And if businesses have more than 250 employees, they'd have to provide a minimum of 9 days of paid sick leave. Businesses with less than five employees are exempt. So very, very small businesses don't have to provide any sick leave. And paid sick leave can be waived in collective bargaining. So when employees bargain with their employers over their benefits, they may be able to sign a waiver to waive their paid sick leave and hopefully in exchange for something else. The city council voted almost unanimously for the paid sick leave ordinance, with the exception of one.
Richard Conlon.
Yes. He said that he voted no because of the last item on that list, that that employees being able to bargain away their paid sick leave may cause some inequities.
Yes, and he also objected to the inequities of employees at small companies not having sick leave, and large companies have some having sick leave. So he wanted less for the large companies and more for the small companies. And, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but don't city council members, being city employees, don't they already have sick leave?
Yes, they do.
Okay, well, maybe Richard doesn't need that job.
Well, it's interesting.
Because he doesn't seem to see the need for sick leave.
It's interesting because, you know, if you're going to give the excuse that that you're against an ordinance because it has some inequities in it, but you're for the concept in general. Generally, you vote for the ordinance and then hope to amend it later. But that's not Conlon's strategy. He tends to vote against them entirely, which makes me wonder if he really is as progressive as he says he is. But one of the issues around the paid sick leave ordinance that I was interested in is that it took maybe a couple of days before a group of small business owners who had gathered at the Washington Small Business Conference in Bellevue this week almost immediately asked the state of Washington to preempt local labor laws, you know, in an effort to try to give the state legislature and governor some direction in how to help the business community in the state of Washington. They directed the state to try to preempt local labor laws, including Seattle's new paid sick leave ordinance. Of course, they also had a bunch of other things on their wish list. They also asked the state to repeal the federal health care law, as if the state could possibly do that.
But remember, Attorney General McKenna has signed on to that lawsuit.
Yes,
against the health care law.
Yes, he has. And they also asked for, quote, business impact statements, end quote, on laws passed by state and local governments. Now, most folks are familiar with environmental impact statements, and those EISs exist because the regulatory environment typically is very heavily weighted towards business interests and not towards environmental interests or the interests of communities who care about the environment. That's why we have environmental impact statements.
In particular, they tend to put a lot of weight on economic analyses,
yes,
which are easily quantifiable, but the externalities that are represented a lot of times by environmental considerations are not represented in
calculations of the impact on businesses, which are already done largely for most laws. So asking for a requirement for business impact statements is really a pretty fundamentally ridiculous notion, since those concerns are usually automatically considered into the economic impact of most laws. But it shows what businesses would do if they could get away with it, including repeal all labor laws and regulations if they could.
Incidentally, this is one of the events we'll have at the end of the show, but the Association of Washington Businesses is having a statewide policy summit next week in Clay Ellum in order to consider what their legislative agenda is going to be for Olympia this coming session. And there will be some protests there.
Yeah, and that would be a very interesting thing to follow, too. So I want to congratulate the city council for going ahead and passing the ordinance, because I think it's barbaric that businesses are not required to provide at least 5 days of paid sick leave. The standard for most professional businesses and most better paying professions is 10 paid sick leave days. So five, that's not asking for much.
All right. Moving on, related to the city of Seattle, it appears there's going to be no grand jury in regards to the John T. Williams shooting.
Yes, that's right. A panel of King County Superior Court judges ruled this week that they would not convene a grand jury to hear evidence in the case of the shooting of John T. Williams. He was the Native American woodcarver who was shot by Officer Ian Burke last August. August 2010. What that grand jury would have done is it would have determined whether Officer Ian Burke should be charged with a crime in the shooting. Burke resigned in February and then was fired immediately afterwards, after the inquest hearing in the case split over whether the shooting was justified.
How can you resign, or how can you be fired if you've already resigned?
Well, he resigned and then immediately afterwards, that's a good question. He resigned and then immediately afterwards, Chief John Diaz said that, well, he may have resigned, but we are still firing him for misconduct. So, yes, it can happen. It's just not usual. But it's interesting. This comes after the King County Prosecutor Dan Satterberg and then also City Attorney Pete Holmes both denied similar requests for a grand jury. So the King County Superior Court judges were sort of following their lead instead of really looking at the facts in the case. So now it's really down to the FBI, the U.S. Justice Department, who's looking into charges that have been made by the community about problems within the Seattle Police Department, and they're also looking at the John T. Williams case specifically to see if his rights were violated.
All right. Moving on, the state has come out with another revenue forecast.
Yeah, the state announced this week that there is a $1.4 billion hole in the budget.
An additional $1.4 billion.
Yes, primarily because of less tax revenue. And they're pointing their fingers almost directly at the state sales tax that consumers are simply not spending. And that matches what we know about the national economy, too, that consumers make up about 70 to 80% of the economic activity. When you go out and you buy stuff, that makes up about 70 to 80% of the economic activity in the United States, and that's simply not happening. So that's blown yet another hole in the state budget. This comes after 3 years of cuts in the state budget, so that now we know that pretty much all of the fat has been cut, and some of the meat and the bone out of the state budget. And it is past time now for the state legislature to consider closing tax loopholes. The state legislature will probably have to convene a special session in December to look at plugging the hole in the budget. And, you know, it is time to raise taxes on the people who are doing well, pretty much the only people who are doing well in the economy these days. Folks like, for example, Boeing, Microsoft, and very wealthy individuals.
Yeah, and again, that's because of the Tim Iman initiative requiring a 2/3 vote in the legislature, even to close the loopholes, let alone to specifically raise taxes for revenues. That may have to come through the initiative process, because you're probably going to find legislators reluctant to take that step.
Yeah, or unable.
All right. Also this week, multiple plans for redistricting our electoral districts.
Yes, every so often the national census takes a look at population distribution in
every 10 years
in the country. Yes, about every decade, and that allows the states to reassign congressional districts. Some states have lost populations and they will have to give up congressional districts. Other states, like the state of Washington, have gained in population, and the state of Washington is going to gain a new congressional district. Well, this year, a panel of four commissioners is drawing up plans to assign a new congressional district and redrawing the boundaries of the current congressional districts. That panel has released four plans. There are four members on the panel, two Democrats and two Republicans, and all four each released their own plan. So there are four out there for people to look at. The two Democratic redistricting plans kind of make some sense. They each create a minority-majority district. The one drawn up by Tim Sice, who is a former deputy mayor under Greg Nickels, he would create a minority-majority district out of Tacoma and South King County. So that means a district that has a majority of folks who are members of a minority a race, like African Americans, Native Americans, or Hispanic or Asian American folks. Dean Foster, who's the former House Chief Clerk, he would create a new district out of the fast-growing parts of Olympia plus the Olympic Peninsula. But the two Republican proposals, when you look at them, they are a mess. I mean, I looked at them, and they both pretty much gerrymander it to try to create more rural districts that would likely vote Republican, but they also attempt to break up the Democratic stronghold of the 7th district, which includes the city of Seattle. Looking at all four plans, I kind of scratched my head and said, you know, it would be nice if we had an alternative that didn't completely redraw all the district lines, that just added a new district where there was more population. But we don't get that because we have four commissioners who are playing politics here.
Yeah. And the state of Washington is one of the best in the country in this process, because in a lot of states, they just leave it up to the legislature. In this case, three out of the four commissioners eventually have to agree on a plan. So it has to be bipartisan.
Or else the state Supreme Court would take over.
Right, which again is nonpartisan. So, in a lot of states, it gets heavily, heavily gerrymandered, because whichever party is in control of the state legislature simply redraws the map in order to favor themselves.
All right. Well, sticking with redistricting, it appears that Representative Dennis Kucinich will not be coming to Washington State.
Yeah, he's not going to relocate to to Washington State. The state of Ohio also released preliminary information on its redistricting this week, and it looks like his district in Ohio, which a lot of people thought was going to be redistricted out of existence because the state of Ohio has lost population relative to the rest of the country, he is instead going to be able to stay where he is. So we probably won't be seeing nearly as much of him in Seattle as we have the last few months, just because, you know, he likes us. It didn't really have anything to do with the fact that he might have been considering running for office here. No, nothing to do with that at all.
No.
But there have been a number of other people who have declared an interest in running for Jay Inslee's abandoned 1st District seat and for the new 10th District, depending on where it's located.
All right. Well, and finally on local, Costco throwing in some more money this week into
our initiative process. Yeah, $1.4 million additional dollars going into I-1183, which is Costco's liquor privatization scheme. I mean ballot measure. This month, $820,000 on September 9th, another $600,000 on September 2nd. That's $3.9 million that it's put in so far, which is slightly over 96% of the total $4 million raised by Yes on 1183. Safeway and Trader Joe's have contributed $50,000 each, which is the rest of what they have raised. On the other hand, the No campaign has raised $5 million so far, with an additional $1 million contribution on September 1st from the Wine and Spirits Wholesalers of America, who have now contributed a total of $4 million to the No effort. They've also gotten $215,000 from the UFCW, which represents state liquor store workers. So $9 million raised so far between the Yes and the No campaigns for squabbling between business interests who are either favor or don't favor the privatization or this particular privatization scheme. Yeah. for liquor, the initiative process, allowing the people to have a voice.
Yeah, it's literally an arms race, and both sides are trying to portray their campaigns as grassroots,
which is laughable,
is ridiculous. And I'm gonna have to say, you know, this October, November, you'll either have to turn off your TV or you're going to have to play your DVDs over and over again.
Get TiVo something.
It's going to be wall-to-wall ads about privatizing liquor in Washington.
All right. Moving on, there appears to be an endless amount of money for our electoral process, but a limited amount of relief dollars for things like hurricanes.
Yeah, over 50 House Republicans in a letter to Speaker John Boehner in Congress this week, essentially reneging on the debt ceiling agreement and pushing him to make steep cuts in discretionary spending in the next fiscal year. And that dispute is holding up relief dollars for Hurricane Irene. Republicans are proposing to cut $1 billion from a hybrid vehicle development scheme in order to offset the cost of the relief funds. This is something that has never been done before, the idea that you have to cut from something else in order to spend on relief for a natural disaster. And there's a certain amount of irony in responding to a hurricane, and of course a lot of the additional number of hurricanes and the additional ferocity of the storms, a direct consequence of climate change and global warming. And instead they want to take money out of a sensible response to the threat posed by global warming in order to pay for the damage caused by it. There's a certain irony there.
And what I find, too, is that there are a number of Republicans that are not for this Republican proposal, and they are primarily folks who are from districts that have been hit by Hurricane Irene.
Moving on, developments this week in regards to the debt ceiling deal.
Oh, I just talked about that.
Oh, okay.
It was snuck in there.
Too much coffee. Paul.
Not enough coffee.
We can't let the half hour go by without
CBS
talking
poll.
About a poll.
No, the New York Times CBS came out with a poll this week. Guess what? People's approval levels of Congress slightly below their approval levels for the herpes simplex virus. 12% now approve of the job that Congress is doing. That ties with October 2008, right when the severity of the economic crisis was at its peak. 12% of the American public thinks that Congress is doing a good job, which, you know, it's really hard to get that kind of unanimity on anything. You can't find that many people who agree that Elvis is dead in this country. But the crosstabs, you drill down into that poll a little bit and you get some really fascinating nuggets. 19% of Republicans and 28% of Democrats, approving of the job that their, congressional, representatives are doing. So, the Republicans are actually less popular than the Democrats, even though they're running things there. And, 33% rather, say their own representatives should be elected. Usually in these kind of polls, what you get is people who think that Congress as a whole is doing a bad job, but their own representatives who they're more familiar with, yeah, they think those folks are kind of okay. Not anymore. Right now, there's very much a throw the bums out, ethic that pretty much transcends party labels and whether the incumbent is a Republican or a Democrat. So it's going to be very, very interesting to see whether that trend holds over the next year and whether we see those kind of anti-incumbent trends in the actual election in 2012.
Yeah, I also found it interesting, too, that many Republican voters who called themselves Republican voters said that when they were looking at the Republican candidates debating for the presidential race, wished that they had more choices. This is among a field of about a dozen candidates, which is something that I found very interesting.
All right. I think it's more better choices than
better
more choices.
Yeah.
Healthcare costs.
Yeah, the journal Health Affairs this week published a study of the reasons why healthcare is so much more expensive in the United States than in other countries, and it found that it results mainly from higher fees charged by doctors, and that the problem is that doctors in the U.S. charge higher fees not because they have higher costs for their medical practice, that in fact the costs are pretty much the same whether it's here or in Europe or Japan, but that doctors here in the U.S. can get away with charging higher fees, and it's primarily because of private insurance. The U.S. relies mostly on private insurance instead of, as it is in other countries, particularly in Europe, where the government can control costs that doctors charge, because most countries in Europe, for example, have government sponsored plans, and private insurance is only a supplement. Here in the United States, most folks rely primarily on private insurance and private insurance provided through their employer plans, where private insurance has a much harder time controlling the fees that doctors charge, and that in the U.S. primary care physicians earn about one-third more than they do in other countries. That the income gap between primary care doctors and specialists is particularly high in the United States, meaning that specialists charge far more here in the U.S. than they charge in other countries.
All right. News out this week about our poverty level here in the U.S.
Yes, the Census Bureau released statistics showing that another 2.6 million people slipped into poverty in the last year here in the United States. The poverty level now is about 46.2 million people, the highest number in the 52 years that the Census Bureau has been measuring that.
And bear in mind that for a lot of those 52 years, the definition of the poverty level was much higher than it is now. The number of people who would meet the poverty level of, say, 1965 is much higher than the number who meet the poverty level today, simply because it's been redefined down.
Yeah, the poverty line in 2010 for a family of four was $22,314, which you could argue should be the poverty level for a single person or a couple without children. It really is set artificially low. Another couple of interesting statistics from that report is that median household incomes fell last year to levels not seen since 1997, meaning that not only have we had a lost decade, we've had a lost decade and a half. I think even more ominous is that the median annual income for a male full-time year-round worker in 2010 was $47,715, which is virtually unchanged or even lower in 2010 dollars from what it was in 1973. That literally points to a lost generation, that American workers really haven't made any progress over the last 40 years. That's an astounding record. In addition, there was another interesting statistic in there showing that the downturn didn't start in 2008, as we've been commonly told, that it really started in the early 2000s, that the period from 2001 to 2007 was the first recovery on record where the level of poverty was deeper and median income of working age people was lower at the end than it was at the beginning of the recovery. That's the Bush years, basically. That's what tax cuts for the wealthy, tax cuts for businesses, and two wars can do to your economy and to the U.S. population as a whole.
Tied to that, Obama's jobs bill.
Yeah, and you know, I find it really interesting that Obama is getting a lot of the blame for the fact that the economy is not turned around in a matter of 2 or 3 years when the economic malaise seems to have been going on for the last generation. Obama's, you know, say what you like about Obama's jobs bill, and I'm a little iffy on some aspects of it, particularly the fact that about half of the $447 billion would rely on tax cuts to try to create jobs when tax cuts, particularly for businesses, have a dubious reputation for creating jobs. But at least he is trying to do something, whereas Congress is not doing anything at all.
All right. FBI article about them in Wired this week.
Yeah, and we're getting short on time, so I'll simply say that the details and all the links on this are at eatthestate.org, so you can look it up yourself. But a great report in Wired this week that a guy named William Gothrop, who gave an interview to WorldNet Daily, the birther website that is so beloved among the far right, several years ago, talking about how all Muslims are terrorists and it's intrinsic to the religion. Turns out that he's been giving trainings, and other people have been giving trainings to FBI counterterrorism experts, basically saying that essentially that Muslim is intrinsically a violent religion, that all American Muslims uh, are uh, are either terrorists or terrorist sympathizers by the nature of their religion, that the Islamic charities are basically a scam that's used to raise money for terrorism, and it just goes on and on and on. The FBI is now distancing itself from this, but you wonder a couple of things about this. Number one, given the politicization of hiring during the Bush years and the rapid and massive expansion of the bureaucracies around Homeland Security, law enforcement, the intelligence communities, and so forth, you wonder how many more of these nuts are floating around inside those bureaucracies. And then you wonder why it is that law enforcement agencies like this keep focusing on Islamic terrorism when we've had so many instances of Christian terrorism in the United States over the past few years, really more than you have of Muslims by quite a bit.
All right. Guatemala?
Yeah, we had an election in Guatemala this past weekend, and General Otto Perez Molina won the initial field of 12. He'll go into a runoff in a couple of months for the election, and this is one more instance. Most of Latin America at this point has center-left or left-leaning governments. The conspicuous exceptions to those have been directly impacted by America's war on drugs and our insatiable appetite for black market drugs, those being Colombia, where a long-running civil war and both sides are heavily involved in the drug trade. And then, of course, Mexico has a conservative government, and there's been a really open warfare, especially in the northern border states there, because of the drug cartels. A lot of the drug cartels in Mexico, thanks to the pressure there by the U.S.-backed money flowing into the Mexican army, those cartels also have been going across the border into Guatemala. There's been a lot of violence in Guatemala this past couple of years. And so Guatemala is now on the verge of electing a general who was instrumental in the 1980s genocide of particularly indigenous people there. So if you wonder why a country can turn around and elect somebody who is in the thick of one of the most notorious genocides of the 20th century, it again is one of these consequences that we never hear of the U.S. war on drugs and the fact that particularly with marijuana, which is what a lot of the Mexican cartels specialize in, because we've created a black market for it, a lot of people are profiting from it and a lot of people are dying from it that don't need to.
All right. Leaves us only about 30 seconds for Palestine.
Yeah. Abbas, the head of the Palestinian Authority in Palestine, going to the United Nations Security Council, he announced yesterday to try and get the UN to recognize Palestine as an independent state. The U.S. has already said it's going to veto that, but it's one more instance where Israel and the United States, by association, very, very isolated in the Middle East right now, between Turkey and Egypt and now Palestine, putting a lot of pressure on the Israeli government to try and reform its practices, and Israel at this point being very, very resistant to that.
All right. Events.
A lot of events coming up in this coming week. Today there's a couple at 11 o'clock. Of course, in New York today there's a massive direct action against Wall Street, and there's a solidarity action today at 11 o'clock in Seattle at the Columbia Tower downtown. 1 o'clock today at Central Lutheran Church there'll be a memorial service for Reverend John Nelson, a longtime pastor at Central Lutheran, prominent member of the peace and justice community in Seattle for many, many years. There'll be a memorial service for him again, 1 o'clock today at Central Lutheran. Tomorrow is the optimistically entitled International Day of Peace. There will be a lot of events around town. Tuesday evening from 7 to 9 o'clock, SOA Watch Northwest getting ready for another annual pilgrimage to the School of the Americas in Georgia, their annual autumn event there. That will be happening at St. Patrick's Church, 2702 Broadway Avenue East, between 7 and 9 on Tuesday evening. Wednesday, as we mentioned, the Association of Washington Businesses having its policy summit in Clay. Washington Community Action Network is going to be traveling there. Details for that, for a march and direct action and a people summit, are at www.washingtoncan.org. And then next Sunday, President Obama is going to be in town for a fundraiser, a lunch at the Paramount Theater. Plan your protests accordingly.
And Monday night at Town Hall, I think, and I'm not going to get the names right, Elon Pop. And I think it's Mark Rutherford are speaking about the situation in Palestine and Israel. So I think
yes,
it's probably 7:30 at Town Hall.
I believe I saw that too, yes.
All right. talking, as we do every week, with Job Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org. And again, there's information there on the FBI story, on the Guatemalan election, and a whole bunch of other good stuff. Go and check it out.